From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, to entertain you are my two partners in crime, the effervescent Giles Morgan. Hi, mate.
Hello, Grant. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Very well indeed.
Good.
And joining the two of us, the irascible Roger Mitchell. Hi, mate.
Irascible. Yeah, everything's good. Delighted with the world. The world is going well.
Really?
Yeah. It's a good time.
Which particular world are you living in?
Tomorrow's my birthday. I don't care about the rest of the world. I've got my little nest and castle, and I'm good.
Ah, excellent. All right. Well, it's good to know that Cloud Cuckoo Land is pandemic-free. That's comforting. Well, gents, we have a guest joining us today. Giles, why not share with everybody who is joining us today?
Yeah, I'm excited this week. I think it's very timely that this guest coming on the show, who is Alex Shiner, who is the boss of the sports practice at Redbird Capital Partners, who are, as we know from when Jerry Cardinale came on the show 6 months ago, a very leading private equity firm. Bit of background: growing up, Alec, he wanted to be a diplomat, which I think is quite apposite, because the diplomacy skills that are required in the modern day sports industry will come in very handy, I suspect. But he did a law degree, which means he's probably quite bright, and that took him into the sports industry and what has become a meteoric rise to the very top. In 2004, he became general counsel for the Dallas Cowboys, one of the iconic brands of the NFL, and rapidly climbed the ladder to become the only non-family vice president. In 2012, he then became president of the Cleveland Browns and oversaw their commercial transformation, which is interesting because they weren't necessarily the most successful on the field, but boy, were they ever commercially off the field. He then joined Jerry Cardinale at Redbird, and their success story is an interesting one, and one I suspect we'll get into because they've been in the news a bit. They made the acquisition of Toulouse FC, and I'm dying to hear all about that. They had to withdraw from a deal with Fenway Sports Group, and most recently have bought a minority stake in Wasserman Media Group. They are certainly sharpening their stick and looking at the sports industry, but this sports industry and the landscape around it is very different to where it's been before.
Excellent, Giles. Well, why don't we just welcome Alex to the show?
Alec, a warm welcome to Are You Not Entertained? How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Giles.
Well, it's really good to have you on board. We're really, really thrilled to hear what's going on in Redbird. But before we do and get into the kind of business meat of the show, we all know as sports industry enthusiasts and also involved in the business of sport that the most valuable part of the sport is the fan. That's the currency that makes everything happen. So we always ask our guests this first question, and it's brought to you by our sponsor, Pumpjack Dataworks. It's about your personal fandom. Who are your teams, and what is it about sport that really floats your boat?
I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and almost everyone who grows up in Philadelphia is a massive sports fan. So I grew up loving the Sixers and Flyers and Phillies and Eagles. And I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. So I went to as many Eagles games as I could. Even when I went to college in D.C., even when I worked in New York, I would go back for playoff games. And I did outside work for the Dallas Cowboys. And I called my mom and I said, this was in like 2004. I called my mom and said, Mom, this is amazing. The Cowboys offered me a job to be general counsel. And the first thing she said to me was, well, what about the Eagles?
Yeah,
she wasn't happy at all. She was just like, why don't you do that for the Eagles? And that first year that I was with the Cowboys, the Eagles went to the Super Bowl. And I would have been there as an Eagles fan. And instead, I was there as an employee with the Cowboys. And I was with our owner, Jerry Jones, on the back of one of those golf carts with all the Eagles fans flipping us the bird the whole time we're going to the stadium. So I've always been a big sports fan, and it was just like really great fortune for me to turn that into a career.
Because you did, didn't you? I've read in your biography that you had an ambition to be a diplomat, then you became a lawyer. So it was slightly accidental, or was it? Did you know that you were going to get in the sports industry?
No, it was purely accidental. I had decided on a career of doing some type of Latin American economic development. I started that career at a law firm focused on representing private equity companies investing in Latin America. And a guy down the hall from me one day just said, "Hey, I know you love basketball. We're working on a transaction with the Washington Bullets at the time. Do you want to work on it and just help with corporate diligence?" And I did. And then that guy left the firm. He went to join the NBA and then after that, the NFL. And I became the go-to sports guy. As the Latin American business kind of dissipated, that business took off. And it was just good fortune because he worked down the hall from me.
And you never looked back?
Never looked back.
Good man.
Alec, whilst we've got you here, you're, as you say, an NFL guy. Give us your thoughts, both as a fan, but also touch on the whole ratings down story about the Super Bowl. Give us your thoughts, firstly, on Brady and Mahomes and where you think the whole sport goes now.
Yeah, I feel like the NFL, like the NBA, as a fan, they're in such good hands because you have so many compelling stories and so many great young players. And in the NFL, that usually revolves around quarterback. Right. And to have a guy like Brady, who's still playing at such a high level, but then to have someone like Mahomes, who you can envision having a career like that, it's just fantastic for a fan. Because there have been points in time in both of those leagues, and those are the leagues I follow most closely, where you just don't have enough superstars. And you know it, right? And again, in the NFL, that's really about the quarterback. And so as a fan, it's just exciting to know you have Mahomes, you have a bunch of young quarterbacks that are good, and then you still have a guy like Brady and Rodgers playing at the high levels they are. And then to answer your question on ratings, I've been thinking about this for a while, and I'm certainly no expert in this, but I do feel like people engage with sports very differently than they used to. And yet we're still tracking the way they engage for the most part with an old style of doing it. And yeah, that's Nielsen ratings. And so this is just instinctual and I haven't measured it, but my instinct is that people engage with sports more now than they ever did. And we're not quite capturing it by just saying how many people are watching TV. And so I do think in the next 5 years and probably sooner, and Giles, your company might be doing this as well, we're just gonna start measuring true engagement and then be able to monetize off of that true engagement, as opposed to using what's become a really unsophisticated tool to do it.
Do you think the currency of sport has changed, therefore, the value currency?
I do. Well, let me say this. I don't think it's changed, right? I think that in the old days, sponsors would pay for this. It was just inexact, right? And so when I started with the Dallas Cowboys and we did a big sponsorship deal, Budweiser knew, or Miller knew, the value of the Cowboys. But it wasn't based on how many impressions the Cowboys generated on social media. But they knew. You know, they had an idea that when you had an affiliation with a team like the Cowboys, the value of your brand will go up. I just think now that kind of instinctual like recognition has turned into, I need to measure this through these different ways. And that way, sports has to evolve as well. And can't just ask for the same dollars without being able to measure it.
And do you think that, as you said, so is your instinct say that actually people were engaged with the Super Bowl or whatever it may be as much as they ever were, but the second screen's become the first screen, or people, it's different bite-sized content, they're maybe getting it through social feeds, that if you aggregated it all together, it may be even that sport is in growth, not in decline?
I'd be shocked if that wasn't the case. I've got three kids, ages 8 to 14, and they just can engage with sport a very different way than I could. When I was growing up, I only had one way to do it, turn on the TV and watch it, right? When I was growing up. And then that evolved into, well, you can log on to a website. But now it's like a million different ways. And they do it, and they can kind of have the TV in the background or watch it on their iPad or whatever. So I'm really confident. And I'm confident because on social media, if you just think about it, it's the most talked about thing all the time still. It's not like we feel like these big clubs don't have a lot of recognition anymore. That does, it doesn't feel that way to us. We're just, again, going by an old way of measuring it.
Alec, let me ask you, you mentioned big clubs there, and they really, in global sport, they don't come any bigger than the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, it's one of the preeminent sporting brands in any sport anywhere in the world. So I'm fascinated to walk through the decision to go from the Dallas Cowboys to Cleveland. I understand from a career ladder perspective to be the president of the Browns was a great move, but you know, poor old Cleveland as a sporting city, you know, until recently, it had been in the dumps for a long, long time. So just walk us through that mental process you went through, because obviously it was a great opportunity simply because times had been so rough there. But just take us inside that decision, because I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to work for a guy named Dick Cass, who is now the president and has been the president and CEO of the Baltimore Ravens. But he was a corporate partner at the firm, the law firm I worked at. And I remember, you know, 20 years ago, however long ago it was, he used to tell me sports is a very simple business. It's selling t-shirts, popcorn, and tickets. And it's not that simple. But what I will say is, like, what I learned at the Cowboys, who pulled every lever and had the ability to pull every lever, was that you can replicate that in other markets and with other brands. And I was excited to do that. So I don't look at it. I understand the outside world will look at it like this massive brand and go into a smaller brand. I looked at it like, how much opportunity is there?
Yeah.
You know, and frankly, the things that you can do well with the Dallas Cowboys, you should be able to do well in other markets. It might not be as easy, and it wasn't as easy. On the other hand, I think we had outsized business success in Cleveland because we just said we're going to pull the exact same levers that we did in Dallas. And then at Redbird, I've taken that to the next level, right? Which is, okay, can we do that in the fourth biggest city in France? Can we do that in another league somewhere, right? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, I'm really passionate about that. And again, I don't think of it. I think the biggest sports brands in the world or the smallest ones have one consistent attribute. And it's what I tell people about sports all the time. Unlike any other business, you don't really lose your customer, right? Like you can be so really bad.
So true.
And your customer's upset with you, but they're not, you know, in Cleveland, they're not going to go to the Pittsburgh Steelers if they're Cleveland Browns fan.
Right.
And so I think that's valuable from Dallas to Cleveland to Toulouse. And I don't think it's any different, frankly.
How much of a tailwind was the fact that Cleveland had been starved of sporting success for such a long time? I mean, that must have been for you guys a great opportunity because there's such hungry fans. And you just have to kind of incrementally get better. And as LeBron proved, the sky's the limit.
Yes, I think it's always nice to start from a position of you can only go up.
Yeah,
it definitely helps. There is, strangely, and I would not have predicted this, there's a bit of an anchor effect to that too, which is that everyone's kind of like, yeah, but it's not going to work. Like, we've been here longer than you and it's not going to work. But for the first groups with the Cavs and the Browns to like bust out of that, then after that, you can't say that anymore. You can't say, well, it'll never work here. It can work other places.
Yeah.
Alec, just one quick question on that. I was just looking at this as an Eagles guy. What did you make of that game in the playoffs and them supposedly lying down to get a better draft pick? What do you think about all of that?
Well, I think that every sports team, I won't talk too specifically about that game. I watched the game. I was like very intrigued by the game. But I'd say every sports team has the duty they have to their fans is to have a long-term strategy and execute on that long-term strategy for sustainable winning, right? That sounds really simple, but it's not that simple. And if that's how you look at it, and that's the decisions that you make within that framework, you will make some decisions that people don't like in the short term. That's just, that's like by nature. It's one thing I've realized being in sports is that every day you're going to make a decision, and some people aren't going to like that decision. And so if you base your decisions based on who likes them or not, you're not going to be successful. You really have to base them on what is going to put us in the best position to win over a long period of time. Again, I won't talk specifically about that game, but I think that's the debate that people are having a little bit, right? And frankly, you know, the head coach wasn't there afterwards anyway. So I think some of the narrative around it probably wasn't even true, right? Which was, well, the coach is in cahoots on this. And I think overall, again, your long-term decision-making won't always be popular in the short term.
Alec, we had Jerry on the show 6-7 months ago, and since he signed off and said goodbye to our listeners from all over the world, it seems that you've been quite busy at Redbird, one way or the other. You've been kind enough, you and I have spoken from time to time, but I would say your inbox has been full recently. Dealing with some of those, but most recently of all, you've just made a very interesting minority stake investment in Wasserman Media Group. Tell us about that. Very interesting.
Well, I think, you know, we have been busy, Giles, and in a weird way, the pandemic opened up the ability for private equity funds to invest in sports. I think it's always been a somewhat closed ecosystem, especially when you talk about the people who actually own their own brands. It was hard to break in and to have that conversation. And I think that's changed over the last year because of the disruption in sports. And then if you think about how we invest, and I know Jerry talked about this, we try to partner with the best rights holders in sports. That's our goal. And Jerry's done it throughout his career. He did it with the Yankees and the Yes Network. We did it with Legends and the Cowboys and Yankees. Jerry did it again with the NFL and the Super Bowl. We've done it with the NFLPA and MLBPA. And Wasserman, other than just being a great business, Casey's a great brand. You know, he really is. Like, he's a true, like, lifelong friendship with Jerry. But more importantly, being associated with Casey and Wasserman puts you at a different level. And so in some ways, it's not at all inconsistent with what we try to do all the time, which is partner with the best people we can and then drive value from there.
Alec, can I ask a little bit about that whole sector? I read when you made that deal, Jerry was very clear that it was about to supercharge that business. I can't remember the exact terminology, but he didn't give the impression he was taking that stake to keep it where it is, and he wanted to push on. That's a sector, if you think about Endeavor and you think about CAA, that's a sector that some people would say is going to go through a hell of a lot of disruption. Where do you see that real driver for growth in the traditional agency model going forward?
I think, you know, Casey's developed a really diversified business, and it's not just a typical agency. Not that there's anything wrong with a typical agency, but Casey's figured out a way to bring a ton of value to companies around the world as they look at sport. And that's really intriguing. And my guess is, as Jerry thinks about driving value with Casey, he's focused in that area. And Casey's ability to, and this goes back to the first part of this conversation, Casey's ability to use metrics to value sport and then to have companies understand the true value of sport, whether or not they're a client, a team is a client, a player is a client, I think that is where this is headed. And I think Wasserman's at the forefront of that. And then if you think of it that way, Roger, then the ability to grow it is almost limitless, right? As opposed to just say, okay, how many player agents can we have around the world?
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up a little bit there because, you know, when I was reading about especially your time with Jerry Jones, I think I read a quote, it said something that Jerry said, the greatest asset we've got here is this one star, you know? That's the definition of an intangible. That's brand. And, you know, Giles and I would probably find ourselves on the data side of finding value in sport now. how difficult do you really think it is, you guys being the absolute deal makers of the moment, how difficult is it really now to try and find the balance between long-term intangible brand value a la Jerry Jones and short-term what you call their metrics? Because it's not easy.
No, it's such a good question. Working with Jerry so long, Jerry Jones, I remember being in his office and he would point to the wall where we had the franchise certificate and be like, this is the Cowboys. And what I learned from him, though, was once you have an understanding of the value of that, in what you call intangible, what we call intellectual property, other people call it brand, then you can build businesses around that. And that was my biggest learning there, right? So the Cowboys, and I think this is still the case in America, the only team in America to make all of their own merchandise. But that's essentially, for Jerry, that was an extension of the brand. Why should someone else be able to make our merchandise? Why should someone else be able to make the hot dogs at our stadium? And I think that's, again, that taught me really well. And so at Redbird, if you think about it, we have the same strategy, which was we invest directly in the intangible. And you've seen some examples of that. Hopefully you'll see more as time goes on. And then we'll figure out ways to build businesses around those intangible or that are synergistic to it, right? That we know we have enough confidence that there'll be an outgrowth of that intellectual property one way or the other.
Alec, I listen to this. It's fascinating how, you know, thinking about this in practical terms, you imagine that this model should work with just about every sports team, because as you say, you have a captive customer base that realistically is demographic based. You're going to have the older fans are going to slowly die off and the younger fans are going to come in through the family and what have you, and that's going to continue. What is it that makes the difference between why this model will work extraordinarily well in some places and will be more of a challenge? Is it simply the size of the fan base? Because there must be more to it than that.
No, there's more. It's the perfect question. I mean, sports is the ultimate people business. So there's only two things for every sports team: the brand, the people. And think about the history of sports and think about when those two things aren't at the same level, right? And then think about when a new owner takes over and hires a lot of great people, and then what happens? And we have examples in so many places, and yet, over and over, people kind of ignore the people part of it, right? And so, Just examples like the New England Patriots before the Krafts owned them were not how we perceive the New England Patriots right now. And even when I was with the Cowboys and I got there, we had such a heavy lift in front of us with respect to building a new stadium. And to Jerry's credit and the family's credit, they understood we have to hire the best people from around the world to be successful with a $1.3 billion stadium. And then, you know, you go across the pond, as you guys say, and you see it with a team like Liverpool, before and after, both owned by American groups, and you see the difference in ownership. And so I've often linked to people that the power of your brand does have some connection to how good the people are that run it. And then granted, make it even more tangible. What I'll say to you is, if you hire a great chief revenue officer, you will have higher revenues. And if you have higher revenues, you can buy more players. And if you buy more players, you'll have better input on the field. And then your valuation will go up. And if you look at KPMG or Forbes, they are not static. And they're not static for a reason. And one more example I'll give, because I know the people. I don't know where Oklahoma City Thunder would be valued in Forbes if you just took its brand, which was new, and its market, which isn't big, versus where they are valued. And I would tell you that delta is the people. The people who run it, the ownership, Sam Presti, right? And so I've always been fascinated by that part of this business. It is not... it's not a widget business. It's a people business.
But I mean, the Oklahoma City Thunder is a great case in point, because they did happen to run into Westbrook and Durant at the perfect moment, right? And having those two superstars on that team, there are a lot of people Googling saying, "Oh, they used to be the Seattle SuperSonics." I didn't realize that. You know, it was that kind of amazing coincidence of those two vectors that, that really propelled them, it felt like to me, from overseas.
And they're, look, they're people, right? So when I say people, yeah, it's not just the executives and management and GM,
sure,
it's players. But that said, you know, if you look at their successive drafts, they made a lot of decisions in those drafts and they kept making, absolutely, the right decisions. And so, you know, good people will select more good people and then the brand value will increase.
Alec, you talk about people there. I'm going to take us into one of our favorite themes in this podcast, which is the move from sport, from those traditional values that we've talked about, into the world of content and entertainment and the challenges of that. You know, you've got Ryan Reynolds and Wrexham that we've talked about. There's a whole lot of examples, but the best example, I think, is the one that you guys are involved in with The Rock, with Vince McMahon, and with XFL. Tell us how you think, and it's a perfect question to you because you're a blue chip NFL guy. How do you create a challenger brand like that that's lighter, less traditional, more entertainment? How does that sit beside the gold star product?
Yeah, I think you start from the premise, which seems like a pretty safe premise, that there's more than enough demand for football, American football, right? And so the interesting thing about the last iteration of the XFL was how many people watched it. I mean, that was like, you know, you couldn't argue with that. A ton of people watched it. More people watched the XFL on TV than a lot of sports that have been around a long time. And I think that's just because people love football at its highest level. And I'm not sure you want to or can take on the NFL. The NFL is the gold standard, like you said. But because there's more demand for this product, and then you partner with people like Danny Garcia and Dwayne Johnson, who in and of themselves have so much popularity that it rivals big brands in sports. And then you take Jerry's kind of sports business building acumen. And I think we have a fighting chance, right? But it's not easy. I don't think it's ever been easy. The history of it says it's really hard. But again, the hardest thing typically is finding people who care. And the last group found people who care. And then they were confronted with the pandemic, which certainly didn't help at that when you're that early in the building of it. But our perspective is you've got demand, and then if you have the right operators, you can have success.
You know, of the three of us here, I would be the one that would be more of the supporter of the kind of like more challenger entertainment-based format. And I'm fascinated by the fact that obviously it's got entertainers like movie stars, like wrestling entrepreneurs. I think that is, of all the things we could talk about here, and we will go on to Fenway and Liverpool and Toulouse, that's the one that fascinates me the most, because I honestly think you've got clear blue water, and with those people behind you and your acumen, you can do something for a sport that, let's be honest, isn't on that long in over a year. There's a huge demand that you can fill.
I agree, Roger. If you can find a place in the ecosystem where there's demand, you should do well. If you operate it well and have the right vision behind it. But as you know, and as I tell people, one thing about professional football, it's not cheap. It's not cheap to put on. It's not cheap to put on an Alabama game either. And that's because you need big stadiums, you need big rosters, you need big equipment staff, big training staff, lots of coaches. And because of that, it's historically been hard. Not impossible, but hard, because there's so much that goes into it versus creating a new challenger league in a much smaller sport.
Changing tack a little bit, Alec. We have the rugby going on at the moment. So typically England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland play France and Italy as well. So this is the period of time that for many of us, we really dislike the French, largely because they're quite good at the moment and the xenophobia creeps up. But you can't be xenophobic about the French because you've made a big investment in Toulouse. as you say, part of one of the big cities in France, and what you must think is a sleeping giant. There's been some headwinds, undoubtedly, and those are well reported. Bring us up to speed with where Toulouse are, where French football is, and how you see this playing out in the next 12 months.
Well, Jerry Cardinal was kind and smart enough to let us explore European football for 4 years before we made an investment. Because when I first went to him and I said what I told you guys earlier, which is, it's the same levers and we know how to pull these levers, I think he was cautious and rightly so. Okay, fine. But Europe's not North America. And let's make sure we understand what we're getting into. And so from 2016 until last year, we looked at over 80 European football clubs in 9 different countries, in 13 different leagues. And when I say looked at, I mean looked at.
Right? It was at a gastronomic road trip. That sounds like a trip I wanted to go on.
It was, you know what? I thought it would be, Giles, since I was like going from one place to another. There, we had one trip, Isaac Halliard and I, where we went from Spain to Italy to France, back to Spain, all in like 3 days, and then had to get back to the office. So it was never quite as romantic as I thought it would be on paper. But by virtue of looking at so many clubs, we started getting to the place that's like, we know what we're looking for. And it might be different for everyone who's a buyer. But for us, it was like, we want to find a city that's big enough and desirable enough that other people would want to buy the club there. Right? That's number one. Let's just start from that premise. And then we want to have some place that has a strong enough history, but also real operational upside. And then finally, and most importantly, we wanted to find the right partners. And when I mean partners, I mean, you know, Olivier Cedran, who had owned the club for a long time in Toulouse, we got to know him over a period of time and we trusted him. And then we started understanding who could run this club in Toulouse, because it's certainly not us. And Grant, going back to your question earlier, if we believe that people make a big difference, then it can't just be us picking up the phone from New York City and telling people what to do. So we found Damien Camoli, Olivier Jaubert, who had been at the league. And so we had this real conviction that we could operate this club well, even though it was in such a foreign jurisdiction to us. And then even though there have been kind of headwinds with the media, what I'd say is, other than that, it's been a great success for us so far. And I mean, we're just getting started, but the people are great. The club has been performing well. I think we're slowly transforming the business. And I'm really proud of what we've done in such a short period of time. And I think whether or not we get promoted, and hopefully we will, but whether or not we get promoted, we've had a really good run with our team and our business. And that's all, I deserve none of the credit for that. That's all Damien and Olivier.
Well, I'm delighted for you. As you know, Toulouse is a great rugby playing city as well. And one of the great tours I went on when I was a rugby player as a university student was down to Toulouse. And I've got to tell this anecdote because it's genius. So the French hospitality is the best in the world, as we all know. And Southwest cuisine in France is pretty special. So we're met off the plane by the opposition from Toulouse University. And they gave us the night of our lives on the Friday night. There we were. We were tucking into the cassoulet, the fine wine. Life was good. They even introduced us to girls. My God, could you believe it? And we had a proper night out. And of course, we had a game the next day. And we arrived at the stadium, or in Europe, it's not really a stadium, it's like a shed, to play our game of rugby, to meet the opposition who we'd been out with. Except we hadn't met any of them before. The people they'd taken us out with weren't the team we were playing. So we were all hungover and lost very, very heftily. It was genius.
I love that.
Alec, can I just revisit something you said there? I'd love to pick up on that's this your hopes for promotion, because that must change your mindset coming from a country where essentially it's closed leagues. You know, both the Cowboys, you know, relegation promotion was never something that you had to think about. So how does that change your mindset when promotion and relegation are so important in European soccer?
I mean, on a very personal level, I love it. This personal,
I don't believe you.
Right.
I don't believe you.
No, I do.
The personal sports fan of me, because I do think people matter and that you can operate sports businesses better than others and have a competitive advantage.
That's true.
I love that, right? So I'm imagine a world in the U.S. where you could buy, a baseball team, and you could buy it for $100 million. And if you just ran it well enough, you'd be in Major League Baseball.
Right.
That'd be incredible. I get it. I get why the existing owners would not want that, right? Because the opposite, of course, is true. But no, I find it really exciting, but it is so binary, right?
Yeah.
When I pay attention and watch Toulouse matches every weekend, it's like you have in your head, gosh, if we lose, that could be it. Like, we might not get promoted. We could have a great season. We could finish fourth out of 20 teams, which is pretty darn good. And it literally means nothing. But if you finish second, like, everything opens up to you. And so, again, on a personal level, I think it is the coolest thing. From an investment standpoint, you better factor it in. And one reason we had to look at 80 clubs in Europe and get smart about it was we had to start figuring out who's relegation proof, right? Who's promotion eligible? Who can stay up? Why do they stay up? Because you can't just apply a revenue multiple on a team whose revenues might be half the next year.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, sometimes you can pay a little bit more if they might be double the next year. Honestly, that part of it, I feel so fortunate that I've been exposed to it, because it is one of the, it's like both ingenious and then also so heartbreaking at once. But like, hopefully I won't suffer the heartbreak this year of it.
Well, you know, you've got this, I think this is a huge positive, because I think sport this side of the pond needs the American mindset. And I'm not just saying that. I think I'm well known for being much more favorable to the American way of looking at sport as business, more honestly. However, you know, so we've seen North Americans coming in, and I'm based in Italy, and we've got Venice, we've got, let me think, Bologna, we've got Parma with Kraus now.
Roma.
Roma, the world's second one. And we've also got Spezia with Playtech.
He's got AC Milan, yep.
Yeah, yes, but let's say they're more debt than equity. But yes, is there any of those clubs that were in your 80, Alec? And if so, why did they not make the final cut?
The answer is probably most. I mean, when you looked at 80, you've looked at a lot of the ones you mentioned. I think for us, each one was like this, like, menu of things. And they all had to work together. And sometimes it was as simple as, gosh, the valuation seems really high. Sometimes, you know, we looked at a few that the valuation was great. And then we looked at it and we're like, oh, gosh, we're going to lose $100 million or pounds or euros the next 3 years, no matter what we do. So the valuation isn't really what we thought it was. And then some, too, as we thought about what we're going to build at what we call Redbird FC, there is like a complementary part of this, which is, if you're going to buy multiple clubs, then they all have to be of a certain level, or at least most do, so they can kind of feed and work with the others. And so we, even though we had to start somewhere, we always had in the back of our mind, hopefully we'll have 2, 3, 4 clubs. And hopefully synergistic, yes.
Really?
Yes.
That's a bit of a scoop, Alec.
No, Jerry's talked about it. I'll never scoop Jerry.
So, if you go down that route, correct me if I'm wrong, the Legends business, was that not a little bit of a kind of like central supply outsourcing? Would you think you would do that in European sport as well, create some kind of company like that?
You certainly could. And, you know, the nice thing about Legends was Legends is a sales company.
Mm-hmm.
But the model wasn't a sales company model. I mean, the model could be anything.
Yep.
And the beauty of Legends when we formed it was, we sat around one day And it was Jerry Cardinale and Jerry Jones and Randy Levine. And we sat around one day and we kind of said, okay, we have all this experience building these two stadiums, which are state of the art. How can we turn that into a business as opposed to turning over all of our learnings and people to everyone else for free? That was the start of it. And so if that's your premise, Roger, then you can see the same thing happening in Europe, but it might not be sales, right? It could be something else. It could be data analytics. It could be
100%. Yeah, I think that's the biggest opportunity in European sport, not just football. The search for efficiencies that needs to go to an outsourced model that can grab those economies of scale. I think that is one of the biggest opportunities. The challenges, like everything in sport, is very difficult to get people to move resources and staff into a centralized model. It's a little bit the flip side of what you were saying earlier about people. There's a huge amount of loyalty, and you know, the ticket lady that's been there 30 years, it's tough, Alec.
It's really tough. But you do have, if you own multiple clubs and own multiple assets,
yeah,
you control your destiny. And and once you do that, then you can extend it beyond the clubs you own. I mean, that is the thesis we have. We have time to figure it out, but I think you're totally on the right track. And there are only so many clubs that have the or teams that have the desire to build it themselves. Not everyone is Jerry Jones and the Cowboys, right? And so those that don't want to build it themselves, those are ones you go to and say, we've already got the infrastructure here.
Alec, tell me, keeping in this European theme, is do you think, and from what you've seen, both when you were looking at football clubs around Europe and so on, and looking at the sports industry over in Europe compared to America, which is quite different, both in terms of obviously the sports, but also how sport is consumed commercially is different. Do you think there's going to have to be a great deal of upskilling and reskilling in Europe? In terms of, we talked about data as the obvious, you have to know the consumer, you have to know the fan. And it's something Jerry did talk about. He believes that the sports industry doesn't yet know its fan as well as it should. Do you think that that what you would want to see as investors is an improvement in those skills in the sports industry in this side of the pond?
I think the evolution of sport everywhere, and everyone's on a different continuum, right? Even in America, the different leagues and teams are different phases of their development. I think the evolution of it is turning it from a hobby to a business. I really do. And I think that, and I'm really, 100%. When I say that, I'm talking about owners. The fans deserve to treat it like a hobby, right? For the fans, like, this is a passion. That's the definition of the word fanatic, right? But for the owners, if they can start looking at it like a business, then everything, Giles, falls from that. And that's the truth of the matter is that one reason that American sports has succeeded so much economically is because they put guardrails around the owners so they can't do things like fans. It doesn't always work, but that's why these closed leagues and the economics work. And guess what happens? When the economics work, then it forces you to make more rational decisions. When you make more rational decisions, your people get better, and then everything flows from that. And so one person who I'm close to, who I love in sport, is Billy Beane. And Billy says, there's two things that matter in sports, winning and making money. And guess what? You can only control one, right? Like, and so you see so many people who destroy their business just to win. And frankly, you could also choose, let me run my business really well and focus on money. And so I that's a long-winded way, Giles, of saying, yes, I think that people will change, but only when the owners start thinking of these as businesses. And by the way, I believe that benefits the fan over time.
100%.
Doesn't hurt the fan. But fan, you know, there's this immediate reaction. Ooh, I don't like when the owners treat it like a business. But you're better off than the roller coaster of spending and losing. And then now you might have to sell the club to someone else, run it responsibly like a company. Everyone else can, and you'll have a great league.
Alec, how have you found that that much more parochial attitude towards sports teams in Europe? It seems to me, I've spent a lot of time in the US and a lot of time in Europe, and there is a very different attitude, you know, particularly I think when owners come in from outside the town, obviously, let alone another country. How have you found adapting to that more parochial attitude?
I'd say two different answers to that, Grant. Number one, I believe this, and I work for the Cleveland Browns, who I think are legitimately owned by the community, right? Like, and Jerry yeah. Jones used to always say, I don't own it, like I'm holding it for a certain period of time. And so I don't think it's as far away as you might think, right? Which is that it almost every fan believes they own their team. They don't really think someone else owns this team. And that's why there's sports radio where they're calling in nonstop and telling people what to do.
Right.
That said, there's a different element of it, I think, in Europe. And we've always, and Jerry's part of now has been great about this, we've always been very sensitive culturally to that, right? And that does mean, Roger, the levers you pull in business might be a little bit different in Europe than in the US, because there are going to be some cultural sensitivities to the levers you pull, you know, and it 100%. Might be that if you're in Dallas, that has a history of selling PSLs, when you build a new stadium, you can sell a lot of PSLs, but it might be that in Toulouse, you can't do that. And so not, you still are looking to optimize your business, but you're recognizing that culturally the fans might have a different relationship with your club. And so, and Grant, we're like very patient with that, you know, being people been in, one thing about being in sports a long time and screwing up so much, right, is you kind of realize, oh, all right, I'm just going to watch and see how the fans feel about some of these things. And then you can take your cue and you don't have to be so impatient.
Yeah.
Alec, when we spoke to Jerry in the summer, it was the start of what probably would now be seen as the SPAC wave. And Grant and I come from very much a finance, macrofinance background, and we've seen SPAC waves before. We can get into the specifics of, you know, why the Fenway one didn't happen. Was it because of the disclosure that you would have had to have given about an MLB team, or was it about valuation or about raising the external money? I want to ask you a specific question, and you can answer it with that example if you want. The thing about SPACs is it puts you under pressure to buy a business. And when you've got a lot of SPACs, because there's a lot of capital sloshing around, you've got a lot of guys under pressure to buy a business. You know where I'm going with this. That's only doing one thing for valuation, and they ain't going down. How do you manage to keep disciplined when you've got the clock ticking on one side and owners saying, well, the guy that was in before you an hour ago offered me a lot more?
There's a lot to that. Let me start with, I won't comment on anything specifically we've looked at, probably because I can't. But I think when we launched our SPAC, it was right before the SPAC wave. Okay. And it's not, we weren't smart enough to know there would be a SPAC wave. And in fact, I wasn't smart enough to know what SPAC stands for at the time. That said, I think by virtue of who we are and why we did the SPAC, we don't have those similar pressures, Roger, that everyone else does. Because we have a private equity fund and we have capital that we can invest. And when we see things to invest in, we don't need to use the SPAC to invest in those things. And we can invest privately. And what that allows us to do, and so the SPAC is like a portion of what we're doing is very small. And so it allows us to use the SPAC the way I'm sure Jerry said with you guys we would, which is another tool in our toolbox. And it's just a different way to invest, right? It gets you into the public markets. It's more long-term investing typically than a private equity fund. And then we bring with it Billy Bean's expertise, Luke's expertise, Jerry Cardinale's expertise, and it's a pretty sizable SPAC. And what I've found, what I've noticed is we're not really lumped in like everyone else. And I think because of that, we don't see the desperation maybe that others would. All of that said, that 2-year kind of ticking clock is important, right? And it is different that you have to figure something out within 2 years. And I think you're exactly right. That drives up value, because even if we're different, if everyone else is like the same, then it'll have an indirect impact on us. And the sellers won't normally, you know, they don't have to care about why we're different. They're just saying, well, the valuations from everyone else are higher. Look, these things typically work themselves out. And as you can probably tell from earlier parts of this conversation, I'm a long-term thinker. You know, I like to think like, okay, we shouldn't react to every day what happens. And I think because of that, we'll be fine. But that said, we could not have predicted what would have happened in the SPAC market after we launched our SPAC. We were like the first that got a lot of notoriety, and it felt like after that, every single person in the world did it.
Alec, interesting that you talk about the long term, and we've been in COVID, which has provided, despite the sadness, obviously, of a global pandemic, it's probably provided the sports industry with a moment in time to really decide what the commercial landscape is going forward. And I think for a lot of rights holders and all sorts of sports, they've had a chance to catch up and perhaps look to modernize. I wonder, as you know, I used to work at HSBC, which is a massive global bank, but it's got massive tendrils in Asia. And sport is big news, as it is all over the world. What's your view sort of long-term in, I mean, to say Asia, we're talking about two-thirds of the world population, but what is your view on Asia and sport and growth and potential?
Well, let me take one step back, which is I think the pandemic at once changed sport, I think, forever. And on the other side, I don't think it changes the value of sport. Like, and you've seen that in the U.S. When these teams trade in the U.S., they're not trading at big discounts. They're not trading at any discounts. And that's because people will look at this as like, okay, there's a two-year blip. It hurts our cash. But then we're going to go back to being whatever team we are. But on the other hand, how people engage with their teams, I think, has changed. And it might go back partially, but it won't go all the way back, Giles. And what I mean, I talked to a guy who was with the team earlier in the year, and it's such an interesting point. He's like, this forced us to connect with our fans rather than just sell tickets to them. And if you really think about it, like, if you think about sports, again, it's pretty simple. Like, the way you interact with most of your fans historically is, I'm going to sell them tickets and interact with them at my games. Because sponsorships are more an indirect way of engaging with your fans. And if you can't sell tickets, which no one's really been able to do for over a year, you have to figure out a way to keep that bond with your fan. So that will carry over. And maybe that'll provide some strength to the industry over time. And then as your question relates to Asia, I would say that we're just starting to look. Hopefully in the next few months, there'll be some news about us investing even further abroad, including in Asia. But again, I'm not smart enough to understand the dynamics of Asian sport. I just look for things that are similar to what I've seen that have the same like components. And then I can say, okay, if the demographics are X and we can pull the same levers, how can we do? And so when we look at Asian sport, that's how we look at it. I'm sure that when really smart people like Adam Silver look at it, it's more complicated than that. But for us, it's just like, okay, can we replicate what we've done before wherever the geography is?
That's a great answer. It really is. Can I just ask you, we're just about to close because we've taken up so much of your time, Alec. I'm really fascinated. Did you meet Al Guido in Dallas at the Cowboys? Were you colleagues?
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
Al Guido. Wow.
Al Guido is a great friend. I love Al Guido. I mean, I love him. We've vacationed together. He's fantastic. I know he was on your show. And he was, the truth of the matter is, when we built Legends, in some ways he was like the most important person for our growth, because the question when we built Legends was, can you build Legend beyond the Cowboys and Yankees? And when we built it, the biggest question was, will anyone want to do work with the Cowboys and Yankees, even if we're the best at it? And they know it's the Cowboys and Yankees. And so a colleague of mine and I flew out to San Francisco and met with the 49ers. And what we relied on was, we're going to give you our best person. That's Al Guido. He'll help you sell this stadium.
Wow.
If we hadn't had someone like Al, then the proposition would have been, okay, we can do it. And they said, well, wait a sec. So some of our revenues are going to go to the Cowboys, and who do we get? And why don't we just go get that person ourselves? And that's why even in Toulouse, it's always about like, okay, who do you have on the ground who can make the success? And Al was the number one person.
Fantastic.
Alec, this hour has just has whizzed past. And
yes.
It really has, yeah.
I've just checked my watch, and I sort of think, I haven't conferred with the guys, but I think we quite like to virtually kidnap you so we could just keep you going. But I think what's been a real joy for me and for our listeners all over the place is, not only has it been interesting, but it's been a bit of a masterclass, I think, for those who are interested in the new sports industry as opposed to the old sports industry. But we can't kidnap you, Virtue, any other way. But we can thank you a lot for coming on. And I know it says, if you're ever in Italy, I've done this, go and see Roger in Lake Como. You will not be disappointed. If you come to London, you come out with me, and that is danger, but you will enjoy it. And if you find yourself in the Cayman Islands, which I haven't yet done, but Grant has promised it, I think you'll have a rollicking good time. But really, from the three of us, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Alec, thank you. That was wonderful.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. That was fantastic for me as well. I appreciate it.
Well, just one caveat. When Giles says you won't be disappointed at going to Lake Como, you won't. It's Roger that'll disappoint you, not the lake itself.
That is a club. That is a club to buy. That's a club to buy, a classic sports tourism town. You know, what was the baseball player that nearly bought it? Mike Piazza?
Yeah, yeah.
I was kind of like half involved in that a little bit, and he got really like treated so badly by the local Como guys here, and he ended up buying another team near Parma, and Como then went bust. But that Como would be a great one to go for. Sports tourism, Venice is another one. But you know this. Anyway, Alec, thank you so much.
Roger Mitchell, Mr. 15% man.
No, I'm too old for all this stuff now. But honestly, it's great to see the Americans coming in and bringing some proper business discipline. You guys know that that's what I think is needed. So thank you, Alec. It was great to hear.
Thank you, guys.
Well, there we go, fellas. That was, as you rightly said, a masterclass. Absolutely fascinating. I mean, it really is. And it makes so much sense, right, that this approach with a few tweaks here and there, it should work across the sporting landscape, because in individual ways, fans are all the same. They all think the same thing about their club. They all think the same thing about the players, the manager, the owners, all of it. So it makes all the sense in the world to me that that's their approach.
It was great having him. I think it's very interesting to hear from the guests we've had from across the pond over in America about the approach. And I think we're learning all the time. And I hope for everybody listening to how they view it. And what I particularly like is that these are not rushed decisions. They're thinking very, very carefully about every investment they make. They're building a jigsaw puzzle. And for me, that was a cracking hour.
Indeed. Well, I guess all that remains after thanking Alec is to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in again this week. Please do take a moment, if you have it, to rate and review the show in iTunes. It really does help us. You can follow us on Twitter if you're not somehow doing that already. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's the word, A-R-E. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And you'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
You'll find myself, RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Bye-bye.